We're talking with Dr. James Trosco, who is one of the original faculty members of the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development. To begin with, Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, very briefly, I was trained as an undergraduate in the area of chemistry and biology. And I was motivated to go into science when Sputnik went overhead in 1957. And that stimulated me to finish my undergraduate degree. And then I entered graduate school here at Michigan State University, whereupon I finished a master's and a PhD in radiation genetics, because in the context of why I was studying what I was studying, there was the Cold War going on in the United States, and Russia were competing with each other by dropping hydrogen bombs all over the place. And that's what stimulated me to focus in radiation genetics on that area, because I was concerned about the fallout having effects on human health. Well, that led me very quickly to an experience at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where I furthered my professional attempts to become a scientist in this area, because that was the mecca, if you will, for radiation biology at that time. The mecca in the world, I might add. And during that time, again, the context of the world that influenced my thinking, my values, and in fact my professional development occurred with the Vietnam War going on, with the Kennedys, Martin Luther King having been implicated subsequently in disasters, obviously. But during that 3 years of being trained in the area of radiation genetics, I had an interesting experience that led ultimately to my coming back to Michigan State. Namely, about 3 weeks before my postdoc position ended, in which I was so engrossed, I didn't realize that my job was running out. And they didn't offer me a job to stay there, whereas all my other peers, the five other postdocs, were offered jobs to stay at Oak Ridge. So I scrambled around to get an offer anywhere, and the first offer was in Fargo, North Dakota. I went there January 14th, I'll never forget that, because it was 40 below zero when I landed in the airport. And I realized after 3 days being in Fargo that I was not meant to be a South Dakotan. North Dakota, rather, I'm sorry.
Is there a difference?
Apparently not. But, but anyway, I came back, and just fortunately, the very day I got back to Oak Ridge, there was a recruiter from Michigan State University coming through, and I met him, and he said they're hiring 250 people that year, 1966, wow, at Michigan State University, and they would look very highly upon bringing, you know, well-trained scientists to the university. I says, since the time is running out for me, I says, sign me up. And while I won't go into this story, which I think is a very interesting story of my last day at Oak Ridge, saying goodbye to this very famous director of that illustrious lab, I may save it for later if you're interested. But anyway, I made it to East Lansing late August 1966 to be hired as an assistant professor, tenured track, in the Department of Natural Science in the old college, University College. I had never spent one day in my life teaching, either having been trained to teach, let alone having the experience to teach.
Okay, and two questions.
Sure.
One of them, so your PhD experience didn't give you any teaching?
None. Because I was on a career development award that allowed young students to go into science because of the Sputnik. Mm. And we were there to compete with the Russians as fast as possible. Okay. And they excluded all the requirements for social sciences and the humanities in my coursework. And I didn't have to do any graduate assistant teaching. It's get your training and your research, your thesis done so you can go out and compete with the Russians.
And when you finished your PhD and went to Oak Ridge, did you ever think you'd come back to Michigan State?
No. I had no idea. I was so engrossed and so naive about the real world. The only thing I can tell you that may encapsulate my naivety as well as my immersion in science was my father, who had never gone past the eighth grade in school, worked in a foundry for 44 years. I was the first in the immediate family to ever go to college. And when I got my undergraduate degree, he came to me and said, "Jim, now that you've finished your training, I can get you a good job in the foundry where I work." And I says, "No, Dad, I'm going on for a PhD. And when I finally got my PhD, my folks came to the graduation, and I had my cap and gown, what have you, and there's tears in his eyes. And he had no idea what a PhD meant. And finally, he again came up after the graduation ceremony and said, "Jim, now that you finish your training," he says, "I can get you a good job in the foundry." And this is the honest truth.
I believe it. Yeah.
And anyway, I went on to postdoc. And after 3 years of postdocing, I accepted this real job to come back to teach. And like I said, when I went to Oak Ridge, I really never even thought about getting a job. In fact, that's why 3 weeks before the end of my fellowship, I didn't realize I wasn't going to stay there at Oak Ridge forever, and I had nothing to go to afterwards. It was such a shock to me. Literally, I would have taken the job in the foundry at that time. But anyway, I came back to Michigan State, and I was thrown to the wolves.
What was University College?
University College was a unique experiment in American higher education. Actually, it wasn't that unique, but it was unique for a public institution like Michigan State. It was to take these undergraduate students who basically, as everybody knows, who go to a land-grant school, which was designed to help the children of the farmers of America get into the mainstream of the economy of America. Unlike University of Michigan, University of Chicago, or Harvard, or Johns Hopkins, which were designed for the elite professionals, Michigan State was trying to provide good jobs for the middle class and the underprivileged, so to speak. And part of that land grant mission, however, at that time, the university decided to provide these non-elite professional students a broad general education. And University College was designed to take the good parts of the University of Chicago's general education program, as well as tweak it with a little bit of Harvard's and so forth, who at that time were not doing this for their undergraduates.
Right.
And University College had general education courses for the first 2 years for all the incoming students. And the natural science department was designed not to teach science to these non-science majors so that they would become literate in the details of physics, chemistry, or biology, but to have some humanistic understanding of what that human endeavor, science, was. So they had us teach these students the historical, the philosophical, and sometimes even the individual scientific discovery processes. And I have never had any of that in my own training. So it put me and all of my other colleagues under a great deal of pressure for us to understand what we were supposed to teach before we even taught. And one of the criteria for this program in University College was to provide a similar type of exposure to the sciences and the social sciences, as well as English and history, so that we could give them a common examination at the end of the year or 2 years. Well, that, to me, went counter to what I was supposed to do. In other words, I had no problem of trying to meet common goals for the students to meet the university requirements, but I felt that as an individual instructor, I had something unique to add because I was a scientist. I felt as though I was a part of what the students perceived me to be, part of the military-industrial complex that was exacerbating that Vietnam War at the time and the counterculture movement. And I wanted to take that experience and show these non-science students that the act of creativity was as much a part of the sciences as it was the humanities. And this was no easy task because they perceived scientists, in particular me, as the antithesis to creativity. And so in that course, for which I was to meet common objectives with everybody else who was teaching the same course to thousands of students, I interjected my own take on things. And as a result, I felt I was handicapping the students because none of the ideas that I presented were on the common exam. And you know what this, even today, this Leave No Child Behind philosophy leaves out the ability of the individual instructor to motivate the students with unique experiences that aren't just out of the textbook, but really out of the soul, if you'll let me use that word. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, while on one hand I was succeeding in the classroom, as evidenced by positive feedback of the students wanting to come into my classes, I should also point out I came here not willing to give up the science that I had been trained so well at all of these federal laboratories I worked under. So I had to create a research laboratory in a department that gave me no set-up monies, no opportunity, because my teaching load was horrendous. 3 courses a term, 150 students per course for 3 terms a year. And I look back at it now, I don't know how I survived. I don't know how my marriage survived. I don't know how I got through all of that. But anyway, I was motivated by doing what I was doing because the students were tapping into my enthusiasm about teaching science as a human experience, as a creative human experience, in the context of the Vietnam War that was going on, where they were perceiving science to be the antithesis of what's good, you know, in society.
How did they do on the common exam?
It turns out they didn't do badly. They didn't match the grades I gave them in the course because I was measuring them on different things. So, but they weren't handicapped by the fact that my students didn't fail at a greater proportion than the overall group. And I feel that because of, even after 30-some years, I still get feedback from some of these students that my effort not to follow in lockstep what was told of me actually turned out for the best.
Yeah.
It was hard on them, it was hard on me, but I'm glad I did it. All right, in that context, after the first 2 years, this makes it about 1968, it became very evident because of my maverick approach to not deal with teaching in lockstep. Both the dean, Dean Edward Carlin of the University College, and my chairman, Dr. Manny Hackle, really saw me as the wild stallion in their corral of tame mares. And those are, in fact, the exact words of Dean Carlin. I know because while there was a party, which I didn't attend, a good friend of mine was there, and he heard Dean Carlin make reference to me in this context. This got back to me, and I knew that my future in University College were now numbered. I'm up for tenure and promotion. And I didn't just fall off the cabbage truck, so I knew I should move on.
Yeah.
And I saw a job at McAllister College that was open in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I went there for the interview. I was offered the job right on the spot. I didn't even have to come home to think about it. I did come home. I told my wife. I said, let's not exacerbate the pain that I'm going through here. I'm going to accept the job. And it was on an August weekend, or it may have been July. I don't remember the exact date or month, but it was 68, I believe. I had already made contact with the medical school. I knew it was starting, a two-year medical school. But it was something somewhere else. Yeah. And my wife and I decided to go to Lake Michigan for one more last weekend, and we did. It was hotter than hell. We drove up to Muskegon. We were having a hard time finding a place to park along the beach. If you've ever been to the Muskegon State, not the state park, but the city of Muskegon Municipal Park. And all of a sudden, the car pulled out. I pulled right in, and I noticed this big car next to me, and it had an MSU sticker on it. And the beach was just loaded with people by the breakwater. I mean, tens of thousands of people. It was sweltering hot. And I was just kind of interested when I looked at the car next to ours that it had an MSU sticker on it. It was a faculty sticker, and I wondered who in the world might be there. And as we're walking towards the breakwater, because we were going to walk out on the breakwater, I happened to notice this tall gentleman dressed in a suit with a tie on. And I'll never forget this, because out of 10,000 quasi-naked people, here's this person in this sweltering heat with this suit and a tie on. And so I walked up to him, and I don't know what behooved me to do that, because Well, anyway, I did, and I said, by chance, do you own that big car parked up there? And he says, yes. How did you know? I says, you must be a faculty member at Michigan State. He says, how did you know that? So we introduced ourselves, and this happened to be Dr. Andy Hunt. And we walked together, his wife and my wife and I. We started walking out on the breakwater because it was a little cooler, the air off the lake was coming. And we got to chatting, you know, and he said, well, what are you doing here? And I said, well, my wife and I are taking our last weekend here. I'm going to accept a job to go to St. Paul, Minnesota. He says, well, what are you doing that for? And I says, well, because I don't see much of a future here. And he said, well, you know, we're starting a medical school here. What do you teach? And I told him. And he says, you know, we need somebody like that in our medical school. And I said, well, what, you know, what's going on here? And he says, well, tomorrow morning, Monday morning, he says, I have the new Department of Human Development coming. He's a pediatrician. He's going to be running the, and he's going to be hiring new people. He said, I'd like to have you meet him. And I looked at my wife. I said, I just, you know, we have nothing to lose, maybe a day or so. I haven't yet signed on the bottom line at McAllister yet, but I had planned to that week. And so we went back, and Monday morning I called Dr. Hunt's office, and I said, where can I meet, and when can I meet this new candidate for the Department of Human Development? And by the way, he told me at the beach that his whole philosophy of teaching the medical school was to break down traditional barriers of disciplines, particularly of the traditional sciences as that normally had been taught to medical students. But he said, even our clinical departments, he said, part of the problem with medical education is this compartmentalization, of knowledge. And therefore, he told me a little bit about his idea of having these intrinsic multidisciplinary departments with names to go along with it, and how many problems he had with the State Board of Education. I remember him discussing a lot of that. It didn't stick with me, but in detail, but he did discuss this with me. So finally, I did get the time and the place, and I went over and I met this little gentleman, Bill Weil. Mm-hmm. And we got to talking, and I don't know how it happened. It didn't seem like an interview to me. In fact, I didn't even perceive this as going anywhere. I just was being nice to Dean Hunt. Okay, my wife's already packing, and I want to get out of this damn place. But we sat there, and I don't remember a lot of the details of that meeting, but all I do remember, and I do remember that well, very quickly, he converted what might have been perceived as a no-go interview. And I hadn't had many experiences having interviews to begin with, but I didn't perceive this as an interview. Yep. And it didn't go as an interview. It was just like two guys having to meet in a bar, but we were in a dingy room. And we had a fabulous connection. And he said, at the end of 2 hours, we need somebody like you in the basic sciences who can teach medical students the important implications of the science, not a lot of the trivial details which turn off medical students. And I tended to agree with them because they turned off science students. Yep. Okay, I said, I realized it'd even be worse with medical students. And I said, I never have taught medical students, but I'll give it a try. He hired me literally on the spot. And while I was not put in the department formally at that time. If you recall, Dave, the first year must have been 69. It was in 68 when I met him, and we talked about these things. I did volunteer lectures in the two-year medical school. I remember going over to Olin, and then I don't even remember where some of the lecture halls were. They were in North Campus somewhere, Giltner Hall, I guess, and other places. Yep. But I did all of this voluntarily because I was still hired by the University College. And at that time, I had already made now the next move, having decided not to leave Michigan State, but not wanting to stay in that damn natural science department. Michigan State now was starting these new residence colleges, Justin Morrill College, Lyman Briggs, and James Madison. So I jumped on that opportunity because I felt that's exactly the kind of teaching of science that I wanted to do to undergraduates. So I went over there to teach courses like Scientific Concepts of Human Nature, the Creative Act in the Arts and Sciences, Bioethics, Scientific and Philosophical Implications of Modern Science and Medicine. These were different courses that I offered the medical students. And I'm just trying to think now if how accurate this is in terms of timing, because it's important.
You transferred your appointment from University College to Justin Morrill.
Yes, yes. Because at that time, I believe Justin Morrill College was independent of University College, even though the overall goal of these residence colleges was still to give undergraduates the means to meet the university requirements for integrative general education. The only difference was the students were to immerse themselves by living and being taught in one of the residence halls. An opportunity to be in the same classes with the same students for the 4 years, you see. And they could then specialize, whether it was in the humanities, the political and international, or the sciences. And I chose to do this one that melded the sciences and the humanities. That was Justin Morrill College. Well, at the same time now, my scientific career, in spite of all the barriers that University College placed on me with the huge teaching load, no setup money, no opportunities, no incentives to do research, I did it in spite of them. And because of my luck, because of the area that I chose to do research in became a focus nationally, internationally, I happened to be in the right place at the right time. But now I had another problem. Justin Morrill College was a residence hall and didn't have labs, but now I had a grant, a federal grant, to do this research. So I was able to get a laboratory in the old Atomic Energy Commission plant research lab. They gave me a small laboratory there, because I was killing two birds with one stone. For me, it was an opportunity to have a lab to do research that I didn't have before. But what might seem irrelevant to the medical school here at this moment, it really isn't. The old AEC plant research lab, which was funded by the old Atomic Energy Commission, gave Anton Lang, who was in the National Academy of Science, I might add, who was the director of that lab, he got all that money from the Atomic Energy Commission to do research on radiation in plants, but he could care about radiation yeah. other than sunlight being uh-huh. us, you know, plants and sunlight, you know, that's radiation to him. But the Atomic Energy Commission was more worried about fallout.
Okay.
And they were now going to have a big site visit. How he was spending all these millions of dollars, and he needed a radiation biologist. Mm. So he gave me that lab, okay. so I was their token radiation biologist. It worked out well yes. for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, it was in that context now that now the real merging of me and the medical school and our department came to being, believe it or not. Because as I'm setting up this lab and I'm doing some research, I had money to hire a technician. I was now giving lectures not only in the medical school, offering, by the way, some electives to some medical students in the 2-year medical school, mm-hmm. but I was also giving lectures in the graduate school in science, for example, in biochemistry, because I was the only one here at the time trained in human genetics and human diseases. Mm-hmm. Well, I gave a lecture in biochemistry on one of the things that I had earlier done at Oak Ridge, namely associate a human syndrome called xeroderma pigmentosum with exposure to sun, induction of damage to the skin, and the formation of tumors. I gave this lecture to the biochemistry students, and one of those undergraduate biochemistry students happened to be Dr. Howard Brody.
Mm.
But he wasn't Dr. Howard Brody at the time.
Yep.
He was a senior honor student. I came to my lab after the lecture, and a couple hours later, he waters into my lab and said, Dr. Trosko, do you have a position here for me to work in your lab? I need to graduate with an honors thesis, and I'd like to follow up on the stuff you gave a lecture on. Well, I needed a graduate student or a student. I had the money now, so we hired him. Howard, by the way, showed me his CV at the time. It was 4-point in everything. He majored in biochemistry, he majored in Russian, he majored in everything he took, he majored in. And he had a 4-point in everything. So I figured, boy, oh boy, this guy is just what I need. The timing was right. So I hired him, and I tell this story in his presence even, and he doesn't deny it. He wasn't in the lab but 2 weeks, and I think every one of my expensive pieces of equipment were broken.
Mm.
Howard was bright up here, but he was a klutz yep. here. And at the end of the term, Howard came up to me and said, Dr. Trosko, would you write me a letter of recommendation so I could go to graduate school? And I said, well, where do you want to go to graduate school? And he gave me some names, and he said, I'm not quite sure what I want to do. And I said, well, I'm sure what you should do. And I says, unless you're planning to become a theoretical physicist where all you yeah. need is a pad of paper and pencil, this is before computers, of course, I said, I want to steer you away from science, you know, laboratory mm-hmm. science, because while you're bright and energetic, you really don't have what I felt were the technical skills, the manual skills that you really have if you're going to go into experimental biology, for example. And he then said, well, what about medicine? And I looked at him and I said, well, I'm sure some of those same skills translated to medicine. I said, I wouldn't recommend you going into neurosurgery. But if you went into pathology or psychology, I said, maybe you're all right, psychiatrist. And anyway, he did. He applied, and he got into, I think, virtually every school he applied to. But he decided to stay here. You'll have to talk to Howard about why he chose, of all the options he did, to stay here. It sure as hell wasn't because of me. I know that. Well, anyway, another year goes by, and I'm now in the medical school. I'm now in the Department of Pediatrics. But I still have an appointment with Justin Morrill College. This now is an element that raises a little trepidation with me even to this day. Because what that meant was my salary was governed primarily by my undergraduate commitment, half-time or a quarter-time, whatever it was, in Justin Morrill College, as opposed to being in the medical school.
It was half-time when I came here.
Yeah, that's what it probably was.
And, like, each year we had to buy more of your time in order to match your raises with the medical school raises.
Right. And, but, of course, you know the story of Mike Bailey, and I'll maybe come back to that a little later with regard to salary, but here he was a PhD MD, and his salary seemed to be governed not by the fact that he had 2 degrees, but that he had the PhD to weigh him down.
when he got promoted from assistant to associate professor, physicians got a $2,000 raise, and PhDs got a $1,000 raise.
He got a $1,500
raise. So they tried, they said, you know, I'm getting $1,500. But we solved that one.
Well, anyway, so there I am now, a rank and file member of the Department of Human Development, and still tethered to Justin Morrill College. But what that allowed me to do was, now with the medical school building the life science building, this is, I think, now 70 to 71. It opened, I think, in 71. It allowed me now to transfer from the
plant research
lab over to the life science building. By the way, I did forget there was a transient period when I was in the experimental psychology building in the basement, but that only for my office. I had my lab in the plant research lab, but my office was way across campus. But be that as it may, now this allowed me to bring my office and my lab to the life science building and right next to the Department of Human Development. It also allowed me to bring over intact now my teaching experience, my teaching motivation, to really implement what Andy Hunt wanted me to do in the medical school, and that is to bring science to medicine in a more clinical, a more humane and philosophical dimension, rather than understanding all the nuts and bolts and details that you would expect a graduate student of science to know and learn. I'll give you a good example of that, and that is when I was asked to teach the genetics of human diseases to the medical students. Obviously, at that time, and I should point out, even to this day, most incoming medical students have no academic experience in genetics, fundamental genetics. And as you probably realize today, modern medicine is almost completely going to be driven by a genetic component. Understanding genetics, understanding the role genetics plays, interacting with the environment, understanding how to use now medical tools that will have a major genetic component, whether it's genetic engineering or any of the new technologies today. Medicine is changing today because of genetics. But we still have this disconnect of bringing in undergraduate students into the medical school who don't have genetic understanding. So my role, even back in 68, teaching the students genetics, I didn't dare give them the old classical Mendelian crosses and Drosophila, where you really learn the concepts of genetics and peas, of Mendel's peas, because I knew that that would turn them off forever. First, they wouldn't see the relevance of crossing yellow peas and green peas, or crossing eyeless Drosophila fruit flies with red-eyed fruit flies, or any of these classic genetic experiments that led to concepts that our understanding of human genetics is based on, that they wouldn't put up with those boring abstract foundation blocks. So what I did, I started my first classes with these medical students by showing them pictures of human genetic syndromes, whether it was a Down syndrome or an albino or a kid suffering from Tay-Sachs disease, a baby with Tay-Sachs disease, or sickle cell anemia. I showed them actual human pictures, not Drosophila or green peas. And I didn't do anything. I just showed them the pictures. And all of a sudden, the students would ask me, how did that come about? In other words, rather than cramming down their throats the abstract concepts so they could later understand sickle cell or Downs or what have you, I gave them the phenotypes, the experiential base on which they naturally would have a query.
Okay. Where in the curriculum did this fit?
That's a good question. Even to this day when I'm asked to give a lecture, I don't know where the hell I fit. But at first, you know, in the two-year medical class, they were given basic biology, microbiology, physiology, and they didn't call it genetics, by the way. I don't even remember what they called it, but they asked me to introduce genetics in that component. That was for the first, the two-year medical school. When it became a four-year medical class, they had electives, which were human genetics. I taught those. In fact, Dr. Chang came with me, and he and I taught the very first. There was a genetics program being developed here, too. An elective course for both graduate students and for medical students on human genetics and diseases. But that then got lifted and incorporated into at least two different places, one of which I started, and then later it was taken over by Higgins and even later Rachel.
That's going to be my next question, is how it related to what Higgins was doing.
Higgins was primarily teaching what was called clinical cytogenetics. In other words, those human syndromes that are associated with chromosome aberrations. Not all human genetic syndromes are. And I was teaching the broader picture, that you can have single gene mutations without a chromosome aberration. Xeroderma is a good example. But he would be focusing more on the Down syndrome, where you have an extra chromosome or some other kind of human syndrome where you either have an abnormal chromosome or a loss of chromosomes and that type of thing. Well, in any case, Higgins was brought on board to deal with that and also to do real clinical service, which I was not. But interestingly enough, I and Dr. Chang taught his technicians to do all of that work. So while he was in the zoology department, if you recall, teaching basic genetics to undergraduates, he was given a lab in the life science building to do both clinical service work for the medical school, as well as teaching clinical cytogenetics to more or less complement what I was doing. I even brought some of that into the human development and behavior course, right? Was the title of it.
Human biology.
Right. And even there, I was giving lectures to the incoming students during the summer before they actually took the regular courses, you know, to beef up their ability if they didn't have this as an undergraduate. But soon, my teaching commitment tapered off between the years 71 when I moved into the lab and started to establish my laboratory, because in 1972, Dr. Weil and I applied for a National Cancer Institute Career Development Award, which I got for 5 years. And that stipulated that I was not to teach. I was to develop my research career. And right after I got the award, in 72, something interesting happened, because I was still tethered to Justin Morrill, just part-time then. But I was teaching a course on bioethics when I saw a textbook in the student bookstore on Grand River called Bioethics, A Bridge to the Future by Van R. Potter. The name didn't mean anything to me at the time. And I bought the textbook, used it in that course, and I asked the students three things at the end of the course. How'd they like the course? Evaluate me on the course, evaluate the course, evaluate me as the teacher of the course, and evaluate the textbook. Well, the course got an A, I got a C+, and the textbook got an A+. It was a very bizarre evaluation. But anyway, I looked at the reviews, and I couldn't believe all 45 students loved the textbook. So
how many of them had read it?
Apparently all of them, because of the fact at that time, remember, bioethics was a new word in the lexicon. And it was occurring at the time when across the nation, everybody was concerned about genetic engineering. The CELMoR conference was held because people were afraid that engineering genes into anything would, you know, have the whole human race go to hell in a wooden handbasket, as if it's not going there anyway.
And you're going to say, maybe they were racist.
They didn't need genetic engineering for that. But in any case, I sent all these reviews to this author, V.R. Potter, not recognizing the name. And 3 days later, I get a phone call. I picked it up. Jim, yeah, this is Van. Like, I'm supposed to know who Van is. Yeah. You know, I didn't know a Van in my life. And I didn't recognize at the time that Van on the phone was the V.R. Potter of the author. And he started talking. He said, what the hell did you do? And I said, I'm not connecting with him at all over the phone. And he said, all of these reviews you sent me. I said, you're V.R. Potter. He says, yeah, I wrote the book. He said, what the hell did you do? And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, how come the students love the book But in 1,900 colleges and universities across the country, Prentice Hall has decided to stop printing the book because it's been banned and panned all over the country. Yet you seem to have success with it. What do you do with it? I said, well, I didn't lecture out of the book. But I said, this was a new course for which there are no textbooks. And I developed the lectures just piecemealing stuff from the literature and from the newspapers and everything else. And I used your textbook as a supplement or a complement to my lectures, to have something that the students could fall back on. And he says, I don't know what the hell you did. He says, but you got to come here and help me rewrite the book. And I says, well, I just got this career development award. And I says, but I'm supposed to do cancer research. And his voice at the other end says, what the hell do you think I'm doing? And then, oh, you know, like, you've had this experience.
The light dawned.
The light went on. You tried to put the foot out of your mouth. And you realized, this is the giant of cancer research. I said, are you calling from the McArdle Cancer Lab at Wisconsin? He says, where do you think I'm working? You know, he's really being sarcastic with me. Like, who is this bumpkin at the other end of the lake here? And I says, oh, my God. I says, I can come then, because this award will allow me to take a leave of absence. I can do cancer research there and in my spare time help you write the book. So I packed my bags. Kay and I went over there. And for that year, now, again, remember what's happening to the department. It's 1972.
Department's expanding.
Expanding like hell. I've already now made wonderful contacts and interactions with Corman, with Weichsel, with Kaufman. No, was it Kaufman at the time? No, Kaufman wasn't there, I don't think, at the
Kaufman
time, was he?
Kaufman came in 72, I believe.
For some reason, I'm thinking there was another.
Came in 71.
Well, then it was Kaufman. Okay. So there was Corman especially, and Weichsel especially. I'm thinking that my linkage with Bailey occurred after I got back in 73.
Helmrath?
Helmrath especially, because he was in the lab next to me. Helmrath and the guy in biochemistry that Helmrath worked with, who became associate dean of our research in the medical school. Well, anyway, it'll come to me in a minute. But Helmrath and this biochemist worked in the lab next to me. So these people, plus Higgins and I, started interacting research-wise. Weichsel and I even published a paper during that first year. I trained several of Corman's technicians, one of whom was a graduate student who went to graduate school with me at Michigan State, and she came and worked for Corman. And this is a little later. I was thinking of my brain's just gone dead. Our endocrinologist today,
Netzlov,
but he came later.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, during that 72 year, I started to establish a role that Bill Weil wanted me to do in that department. As a basic scientist, he wanted me to help the clinical scientists with my skills working in the lab. And I did train, like I say, Higgins' group. I trained Corman's group. I trained and worked directly with Weichsel. And I even helped Helmrath to some degree, although he was having plenty of help with the biochemist who was working with him on those neonatal pigs. At the same time, as you well know, I was trying to work with the social scientists in the department, especially with regard to what really made an impression on me at that time. I've said this, you and I have said this, and many of us who came early, we really had a sense of mission, a sense of family. Our faculty meetings, we discussed academic matters. How are we going to design a new course? Pediatrics seemed to be, at that time, losing a sense of identity. How could we, with this unusual set of expertises, multidisciplinary, what could we do to write a textbook, for example? Well, we were going to offer this course as a model, if my memory serves me correctly. The model of the course was going to be a framework for a potential book, which never did happen, but that was the motivating.
We talked about it a lot.
Yeah, we talked about it a lot. And I remember that. And I remember talking at faculty meetings about academic matters. Mm-hmm. I say this and I stress this because you know, even the last few months that you were there in the department, we hadn't heard discussions like that at our faculty meetings for almost a decade or more. It was always money matters. How are we going to make the medical school solve it? How are we going to solve these monetary problems of where the clinics are and this, that, and the other thing? Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I went to, this is 72, late 72, Kay and I went to Madison. We spent a mind-boggling year there where all of a sudden my research went through an epiphany. It went from radiation genetics now to what was occurring. I have to bring in the broader context. The bombs were still being dropped by the Russians and the Americans. But Rachel Carson wrote her book, The Silent Springs, and all of a sudden the public lost interest in fallout and were interested in those nasty chemicals that were in our food and water. And while I'm there at the McArdle Cancer Lab, instead of, and I could tell wonderful stories about how I was perceived as a crazy by these giants in this McArdle Cancer Lab. Remember, there was Howard Temin, a Nobel Prize winner, the Muellers, Betty and James Miller, Potter himself, Botwell, Zabalski. I could go on and on. All in the National Academy of Science. Temin was in the was a Nobel Prize winner, and here they heard this young professor from Michigan State University, cocky as could be, telling them, the masters of chemical carcinogenesis, that DNA damage caused by ultraviolet light could explain cancer, especially with this genetic syndrome, xeroderma pigmentosa. They ate me up alive that first week I was there when I gave my introductory seminar to them. And I can't tell you, I can't tell anybody how demoralized, how I went from being a cocky young professor thinking I knew everything about cancer caused by radiation to knowing squat. Because how could I feel otherwise when all these giants in the field were telling me this had nothing to do with cancer? Nothing. And trying to save face in front of these people, I basically said, well, I've been on the move. I haven't read your papers. But unbeknownst to me at the time, all the young people who heard my talk ran up to their labs in that building and started doing experiments based on what my talk was. And eventually, they turned that whole institution around.
And you got cocky again.
Yeah, I got cocky again, right. No, I didn't, actually. Because I changed. And during that year, my research changed from radiation now to chemicals, and not only to chemicals, but to a very specific class of chemicals, which to this day, by the way, I'm getting right to the end of my talk here, and that is I have a paper coming out in the journal Mutagenesis this next month that's entitled "The Emperor Wears No Clothes in the Field of Chemical Risk Assessment." This paper would never have been accepted then or even today if I had sent it to any other journal, either because the editor or their handpicked reviewers would have slaughtered the paper, okay? But I sent it to my intellectual adversary, a man who I have never agreed with. Even if he said it's daytime out, I'd say, no, it's night. I mean, we are so different. We disagree on virtually everything in our mutual area of science. But both of us respect each other. Because all I know and all he knows is we know our starting assumptions.
Yeah.
And these are the two things we disagree on. But everything else is logical, it's consistent, it's solid. And to that extent, you know, in science, you can disagree without being disagreeable.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, most people aren't. They disagree and they are disagreeable. But this particular gentleman and I have always respected each other at meetings and what have you. So I sent my paper to him. He didn't even send it out for review. He says, it's going right in. He says, I'd like to see somebody stirring up the pot. Well, anyway, I'm jumping ahead now. I'm going back to 72 to 73 while I'm at McArdle. I'm changing my field. While I'm gone, something had happened in our department. Since Bill Weil now had my salary, because this was a career development award, in principle, as you well know, in the fine, not even in the fine print, the bold print of that contract, it said my release salary should be there for the department to assist me in developing my career. Well, while I didn't have much of a salary at that time, I was still, I think I was an associate professor. Oh, I was associate professor, I think, when I came back, but I was assistant professor when I was there. My salary was still low. It was still lower than my peers in science on campus. And my salary, as you well know, went to support the forensic attorney from Ann Arbor. You and I have the same problem right now. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But anyway, nice guy, but it didn't assist me in using that salary for hiring a postdoc, for example, or using it to buy equipment or anything like that. Fortunately, when I was at McArdle, I had access to all of the resources except help, of course, that the McArdle could give me to do my research while I was there. If you recall, I did have a grant besides this Career Development Award, and I hired CC as a postdoc, and I hired a technician. So while I was gone, they kept my research going, and I now was changing my field. So when I came back in 73, I completely re-altered my research career in the department. And then my role in teaching had diminished because I was not to spend time teaching, although I did do a few lectures. I didn't tell anybody about it. I just did them. So until 77, from 72 to 77, because this was a five-year award, my role of teaching for the department in the college really was diminished.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already then severed my role in Justin Morrow College. So when I came, when I finished my career in 77, I'm just trying to think whether Bill had now stepped out, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. And now we had Marshall. We had Helfer, right? Helfer was between or after Marshall?
Helfer was acting chair.
Yeah, I know, but...
And then we got Marshall.
That's right. Well, it was... When Bill stepped down, they were going to look for a chairperson, and Ray was asked and dragged into being... I know, I remember talking to him. He reluctantly accepted the position. Yep. And if you recall, he made me assistant chairman because Ray either didn't have the time, didn't have the motivation or interest to do a lot of the academic minefield plowing, I call it that. He dealt with the clinical aspects of the chairman, obviously, and I couldn't do that. I didn't have any expertise or interest in doing that. I wasn't chairman anyway. But he asked me to deal with some of the academic things of the department, and I agreed to do so. And I did. And while I never got compensated for that, I found out later I could have been, but I didn't. But I did get rewarded in one sense. It did give me some administrative experience, although it was minor. Ray then rewarded me by putting CC on the tenure track.
Mm-hmm.
That helped me because, you see, if that hadn't happened, I would not have been able to put the time in to keep the grants going to keep him paid.
Good.
But once he got on the tenure track, then we got him a career development award also for 3 years, which paid his salary for 3 years. Now, in both cases, the department used our salary savings for not...
It's how we live, Jim.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
But I'm just telling you that had I been in a traditional disciplinary department, like microbiology or physiology or whatever, that money would have been plowed directly back into the research of the person who brought in the overhead and the salary savings. And even to this day, you know, Dave, that... there's no uniform policy on this campus from college to college, department to department, even within colleges. Salary savings and overhead in some departments go back either in part or whole to those who bring it in.
I think it wasn't until the 80s that part of the overhead started going back to the department.
Department, right.
The university used to keep every penny of it.
That's right. But in any case... That's still, when I look back at it, because, you see, I was made well aware of this was going on in other universities. And how did I know? Because my competitors were getting ahead of me because of advantages they had with their overhead and salary savings. But be that as it may, that's water under the bridge, so to speak. But it did leave a bad taste in my mouth. So 72, now I'm back. 78, I'm back. And a lot of things have now changed in the college. Not so much, I guess, at the university level, although things were changing there too, but it was noticeable in our college. Our college started to ossify. There wasn't the Cormans, the Callens, the Troscos, and the Weichsels, and the Baileys, and Siegels, and the people who came on board with a sense of shared mission to do something unique. And they actually sacrificed much of their traditional disciplinary careers to do that. Because every minute, you and I and the rest sat at a committee meeting to discuss a course, interdisciplinary book that we were going to write, or even some interdisciplinary clinical projects, which, of course, only indirectly could I get involved. But I did, by the way. I'll come back to that in a moment. Every minute we spent for those purposes, we took away from digging our narrow trenches deeper and deeper. Okay? And in that sense, I realized that I was losing out in my field. I was no longer... I was being recognized as a crazy, or as Dr. Zabalski told me in my farewell party at the McCarno lab. He said, I can understand why that old fool you worked with, Van Potter, is now dabbling in bioethics. He says, but what is a bright, potentially contributing scientist like you doing that? You know, to me that was offensive that he said that to me, because I felt what I was doing with Dr. Potter to rewrite his book on bioethics was as important as clinking another test tube, you know.
Yep, our department did too.
Well, yeah, and I felt secure there because I was doing that. If I had been across the street in the biochem department, I would have been on thin ice.
Yep.
I can assure you, I would not have been promoted. But anyway, that whole episode of all of us committing ourselves to the whole instead of just grooming ourselves in our little narrow niche. I'm not saying that either one is better than the other, except we made a collective choice, and we were supported for doing that, from at least from Andy Hunt's vantage point, probably less so by Weston, who himself never had that germ, and even less later by Abbott.
Well, yes.
And now it's not even a foggy idea in our current dean. But at that time, I sensed when I came back in 77 and 78, having disassociated myself with a lot of the teaching that had been going on, a lot of things that had happened in my absence, but now also in my presence because I'm now doing something completely different. And many of the faculty are leaving. The Cormans, the Baileys, the Helmraths, and they're being replaced by young people who are coming out of traditional reductionalistic traditional training departments in medical school, who never had that original dream or incentive. And now we're saddled with the new emerging national medical education and medical practice problems. They had a whole new set of priorities to survive. And many have came and left as fast as they unpacked. If you recall, we had an immunologist, microbiologist, the black guy. I expended a huge amount of energy to help Marshall Klaus. You remember, he was only there a year. He just never made an impact, and he left at the end of the year. I was asked by Marshall, after Ray died, of course, and Marshall, after Marshall came on board, need not to describe Marshall any more than to say that here was a man who came with a great acclaim for his intellectual research contributions. And quite frankly, even after the 5 years he was there, there was no diminishing of my respect for his enthusiasm for doing his research. But he himself, as everybody was apt to hear him say, he was never made to be an administrator. Mm-hmm. And he was an absolute klutz at it. And while I was never a formal administrative assistant to him, he did confer and confide in me several times. I should point out that those several times included he and his wife specifically asking to come over to our house to have dinner that Kay would make so that he could discuss with me matters he felt uncomfortable talking about in his office. And most of the time, these were matters that Kay and I remember, because even his wife would be involved in, yeah. You know, more or less coaching him to say this or that. Kay can remember many of these details better than I can. But they dealt with those administrative matters, personal matters with other people in the department. He didn't know how to approach these things. He recognized there were problems because they brought the problems to him. He would never have recognized them because he was so oblivious to them. But they brought the problems. Kaufman brought the problems. Nesloff brought the problems. They came in there with the problems. But he didn't know how to deal with them. And I'm sure he confided with other people, but he specifically confided with me over a couple years. I'll never forget the time he asked me to discuss with him several problems, really tough problems. And I knew they were tough problems. If I was chairman, they would have been tough yep. problems, because you know the people we had to deal with. And this was a different time than the times when we first started the medical school. But when he decided voluntarily, he read the tea leaves himself. Nobody had to send him a note saying, you're never going to be reconfirmed for the next 5 years. He knew that he didn't want to do this for another 5 years, and that's why he chose to leave.
Well, but the other thing was that Sparrow cut him out of the nursery.
Yeah, yeah. That was a practical reason, of course. Probably that was, to him, a blessing, in a sense. They gave him a real excuse.
Well, I think if he had been able to work in the nursery, he might have stayed, although not as chairman. I mean, here's a man who's a world-famous neonatologist.
Yeah.
And they won't let him practice, and he doesn't get any referrals.
However, I don't have the complete picture here, but I do remember talking to him about this before he made the formal decision not to leave. He made it very clear to me, in spite of this problem, that he had no stomach. Those were his words. He had no stomach for administration.
Yeah.
You know, that he would close his door with his wife and they'd cover the desk with those book chapters they were writing. You know, this was good stuff.
And he'd let, who was it? Suzanne? What's her name?
Oh, yeah, the tall secretary you're talking about?
She was his administrative assistant.
Yeah.
He let her make all the decisions.
Yeah. Well,
I remember there was something he wanted to do, and it needed some money. And I went in to talk to Marshall about it. His response was, "Suzanne, can we afford to do this?"
Oh, yes, Suzanne Baker.
Yeah.
Suzanne Baker, yeah. Well, you're in a better position to make some assessment or evaluation of all of our chairperson's role in the financial governance of that department. Because you were at in the beginning anyway, and I think at intermediate times involved in playing that role of how do I or how does the department dispense with the limited funds it had. But for many of the faculty, we felt that when the chairperson disconnected him or herself, well, himself from the accounting and picking the people they did, aside from you, all I can remember are the Suzanne Bakers. Who was the priest who was there? Remember? We had a priest there.
I don't remember a priest.
Yeah. He was the accountant there for a while. He was a big guy.
It must have been when I was on sabbatical.
Yeah, you might have been.
Yeah.
But he was a card-carrying, frocked priest. And besides Suzanne Baker, right to the present day, now this, I shouldn't say this, but most of these people assumed the faculty's responsibility to have some input besides the chairperson to decide how limited funds were to be used for the department. The faculty to this day has been left out of that loop.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, other departments, some are worse, others are much better, where the faculty at least has some input by setting criteria by which funds come into the department, whether it's overhead, whether it's clinical fees, whether it's salary savings or what have you. But in any case, things are now kind of muddled at 78 to 80 issue here. We're losing the experienced faculty, like I said, the Cormans, the Baileys and so forth. They, with their talent, their early experience in developing a medical curriculum, a medical school, clinics in a community-based medical school, they now were valuable assets for which other medical schools tapped into.
Mm-hmm.
And they left. We replaced them with people who didn't have that kind of talent, history, motivation, or overarching resources to continue on, okay?
Yeah, although the interesting thing is they left for administrative careers.
Right, they all left for administrative mm-hmm. careers, every one of them. And apparently they all did well.
Yes.
Exactly. But those who were asked to replace them, many of them came and went as fast. Like I mentioned this one immunologist. We had two or three pediatric microbiologists.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Murray was the last of that ilk, but preceding him was another, was it Anderson, I believe.
Yep.
I can't remember what his first name was, but he was only there a year or two and he was gone. And what I'm ignoring, however, was when I came back, I started to work closely with Seroj and the genetics clinic, with the exception of Higgins. Higgins was always a loner.
Mm-hmm.
And his first allegiance was with the Department of Zoology. That's understandable. But he was, you know, a nice guy, soft-spoken. He just never got involved. Dr. Chang and I had many opportunities in which we could have utilized him, and he could have utilized us, but he chose not to. He was not a driven man. We were driven. We were driven. He was not. He was very comfortable with his little...
UMCC were driven more than most other people.
Well, that's true, too. But we were driven to help people like Higgins, but he chose not to, and we didn't interfere with that, okay? You know, you can't force collaborations. But with Saroj, and at that time, Roshni, especially Roshni and Saroj, and Netzlov now was coming on board. Netzlov, Saroj, and Roshni, as clinicians, really wanted initially to have some research experience. And Marshall Klaus asked me specifically to expend time and energy to bring them in the lab. Now, I was given no resources to do that.
Mm-hmm.
None of my grants were there to train clinicians, but I gave them the opportunity to use my resources, and in the end, nothing happened. It was wasted time and effort. And there's a lot of reasons for that, one of which is our community-based medical school. Here I would have, for example, Saroj in my laboratory, teaching her how to do this sophisticated technology using the sophisticated equipment for a project that would be really helpful for her in pediatric leukemia. Here I am, an expert in cancer research. She would spend the first hour and a half getting the techniques going and what have you, and all of a sudden her beeper would go off. She's got one of her kids dying or got a bad side reaction to the chemotherapy or whatever. She has to run off. In the process, $200 worth of this experiment now are ruined because I didn't have the time, I didn't have the personnel to help her continue that experiment while she was gone. So it was just wasted. And after a good deal of time, we did this for well over a year and a half, or maybe even 2 years, we then realized this isn't going to work. She's never going to get the training. She's never going to have the time. She'll never get a grant. She'll never write a paper. Mm-hmm. It's never going to work out. Too bad. CC, myself, wasted all our energies, time, and money. And Marshall, you know, he didn't realize what effort had to be taken to do all this, and he didn't see the significance of the loss. But on the other hand, my contributions to the clinical aspects of pediatrics through Saroj was different.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, Mike, because they then were having this genetics cancer clinic, and they would have patients come in, pediatric patients come in, that have cancers. And, you know, as I teach in the medical school class, cancer is it's an age-related disease. So if a person gets cancer, usually before the age of 40, a red flag should go up.
Yep.
There's got to be a genetic component. And obviously, if a kid is born and never has a chance to get out of his diapers and gets a cancer, definitely you've got to suspect genetics. So when Saroj and Mike would get a young pediatric cancer patient, they would come to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not see the patient legally, okay? But I could sit down with Mike and Saroj to go over the genetic information that they had already gleaned from their discussions with the parents and give them some insight. And in some cases, I could even talk to the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a clinical formal setting, but just because I'm a professor at the university, at a state university. If they want to talk to me, make an appointment, they could. I never charged them anything. I could just give them information. One of which, one such parent brought to me by Saroj, is a case that even to this day is, it illustrates my role in the department. Saroj asked me to meet a faculty member here at the university whose son, at a very early age, had something like a couple hundred tumors. A couple hundred tumors. And she was very worried that the oncologists and surgeons were going to kill the kid with surgery and radiation. And yet she had no way to overrule these other clinicians' medical plan for this kid, because she really didn't understand why would a kid that young have a couple hundred tumors. So she brought that information to me, and after I talked to her about the history of this kid, it seemed quite obvious what was happening. So I was asked to meet this faculty member for lunch, and the faculty member, who's the parent of this kid, ultimately discussing it with the surgeon and the oncologist, have to make a decision, a medical decision, on what to do. And I convinced her that if the surgeon and the radiologist got to this kid, they'd kill him. And that they should, she should, with her husband, tell them my interpretation of what was going on, and that they should only intervene if any one of those tumors became life-threatening, for example, occluding their breathing tube or squeezing their brain. Mm-hmm. Okay. The other tumors, I said, or all of the tumors, are benign, and that they would recede when the kid went past his growth spurts. 4 months ago, I met the kid. He's now graduating from Michigan State University. And he went through 4 bouts like this during his growth spurts. But because they adhered to my suggestion, Saroj and the healthcare team managed this kid. And now, probably, he will live a normal life less he starts smoking or do something crazy that will exacerbate the underlying condition. But the point I'm trying to make here is, with that role of mine is to assist the clinical geneticists, Netzlaw, human geneticists, and Saroj, and to some extent Roshni, not to some extent, to an extent significant, whenever they brought to me genetic cancer-related patients, I could have input, you know. And I felt good about that, even though, you know, I never got any clinical reimbursement for that, and I was legally able to do that as a PhD, but I could provide them scientific information by which they then could handle the case. Okay. Well, finally, we're getting near now by getting through the 78 through the bulk of the 80s, where I really did sense beginning to feel not a part of a whole or of a family anymore.
When was that?
Probably 80. It's got to be mid-80s. And now Netzlaw No. It's 89 is when I got the phone call to go to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I got a National Academy of Science leave of absence to work at the Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, to be the chief of research to oversee the quality and nature of the research on the A-bomb survivors and their offspring. And that was from 1990 to 1992.
That's sort of full circle for you.
Full circle. Full circle. Exactly. And I chose to go there for a lot of reasons, not the least of which, already by that time I had several Japanese postdocs working in my lab, in our department. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with Japan for, again, a lot of reasons, historically, just all kinds of reasons. I can't, you know, single out one. And I had visited Japan scientifically through my postdocs. So when I was offered the job in late 89, I took it right on the spot because of this malaise I was feeling in the department. And we now had gone through Bill Weil, we had gone through this interim helfer, we had gone through Marshall Klaus for 5 years, and then after Marshall, it was Netzlaff.
Yep.
And it was really in that period of the Netzlaff time. While I personally never had any problem with Mike, never. He and I, like I said, interacted, even wrote mm-hmm. a paper together early on. And through the clinic, Mike respected me. Mike sought my advice. I sought his. And there was never any, I can't remember any reason why he as the chairman and I as a faculty member had any encounters in that context of chairman and faculty members. I do know that others had problems, mm-hmm. and I could only glean from our faculty meetings that there were problems brewing outside the college with the town gown problems. I don't know how much was of Mike's doing, how much just because I wasn't involved in it. And at that time, I could care less. But things were changing, and that's when I really felt, what am I doing here anymore? I didn't feel a sense of mission anymore. I didn't sense in the faculty meetings that there was any academic intellectual discussions. This is when a lot of the things that were discussed were financial problems mm-hmm. and are we going to move the clinic from here to there, and you know, the Sparrow problems, all of these things, which are ongoing to this day.
But what they used to call was negative incrementals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I just drew the wagons in, so to speak, my laboratories. Mm-hmm. And then when I chose to go to Japan, it was in not large part, but definitely a significant part of my decision to go there is just to get out of the department mm-hmm. in this malaise. It was a great decision for me because having left the department and falling into this historic institution to study the atomic bomb survivors, which had been going on at that time almost for 50 years, here I was just a little person from a little university to play a role that these big universities like Ann Arbor, University of Texas, and Rochester had played there.
Mm-hmm.
And culturally, it was a great experience. Socially, it was a great experience. All of things just made that 2 years something that I didn't even have to reflect back on the bad things that were going on at Michigan State in our department at the time. So when I came back, however, there was a lot of other new problems, not the least of which is, you may not remember, but 1990s, as soon as I left the campus, the Dean Weston chose to start a breast cancer center on campus and never consulted me. I was the senior cancer researcher on campus, and they didn't consult me. So when I came back, I now had to readjust my lab. I had to readjust to problems in my own research field with things that were happening there with the breast cancer center and with Dean Weston. And I think about that time, I'm trying to remember how long after I got back that Weston was relieved of his duties.
Pretty soon.
I was here when that happened. It must have been maybe within that first year, 1990. And Abbott was put on as dean. And all I can remember at that time, I hope this isn't, well, it is going to be taped and accessed to the public. Bill should never have been made dean of this medical school. It was the worst choice at the worst time, and it just kept going on and on and on. And I could never figure out why the faculty, the administration, allowed this to happen.
Oh, I know why the administration allowed it to happen.
I'd like to hear what your view is.
Because every time David Scott called up and said, "We need to reduce your budget," Abbott said, "Yes, sure, and can I give you a little extra?"
Yeah. Well, in general, what you just said, I think, fits the overall impression of everybody, and that is the university itself, central administration, and possibly even the department chairman, didn't want a strong dean. The strong dean would have, told the central administration
where to go,
and at that time, the department chairman, the fundamental human nature element here, and that is, people who are self-confident and competent have no problem surrounding themselves with people who are better than they are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's those who are less confident in their own abilities that always want to surround themselves with people who are weaker than they are. That's how they survive. A strong person isn't afraid as a chairman to hire faculty who are better than they are. And a president of a university isn't afraid to hire a good one, to hire a dean who is damn good and who will talk back and provide information instead of being a yes man. But we know that there are people who are in positions of power who just love yes men. Okay. So anyway, to make a long story short, because I know there's so much in the since 1968 to this day, and I'm still in the medical school, that I haven't covered. You could probably ask me specific questions and I could resurrect from the bowels of my brain some stories, which, by the way, I haven't even reflected on, some anecdotes. They could come up with specific questions, for example. I might remember them. But to this day, in my last era with Dean Glenn Davis, I do have a couple parting remarks to make. In fact, it goes after or before Glenn Davis became dean, and that's when we had the acting dean, the guy who went west just before him. He was a psychiatrist.
Western?
No.
Okay. He was chair of psychiatry.
Yeah, chair of psychiatry. Yeah. I remember him vividly at the 40th anniversary, I think it was, or no, it was your retirement party with Betty Siegel and was it Kaufman?
Yeah,
the three of you at the University Club. And here was this guy standing by the bar.
Enzer.
Enzer was a psychiatrist there, but he was with us throughout the early history. Oh, what was his name? But anyway, he was standing there by the bar throughout all of these slides and stories that were being told of you three. And I got up to get a glass of wine, and I introduced myself to him. And he told me he was the acting dean, and I didn't even know. I had never met him. I heard that we had an acting dean, but I didn't know who he was. You know, that's the first time I faced him. And he was asked to be at the meeting, obviously, or at the party. And he asked me some question, because one of you guys, maybe it was Bill Weil, got up and showed a slide of me or whatever in the context of you three retiring. And he said something about my role in the department. I said, well, I've been here, you know, forever. And he says, well, I don't know any of these people. He says, I don't know the history of this department. And he says, this seems very interesting, that this camaraderie that he could feel, you know, it was palpable.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is wonderful. And I remember him saying that to me. And I said, well, you know, these three people leaving right now are leaving a real hole, a black hole, because they are in large part the living history of our department. And once they leave, there's not going to be anybody but maybe in part a little bit of me left. And he said, well, that's interesting. And we talked later after the party kind of settled down and people got up and talking to people and drinking. And I met with him later. And by the way, I met with him later not so much about this context and about his role as dean or my role as chairman, and I needed his help at that time, but because of my son, who is, as you know, bipolar schizoid. And he and I talked, and he says, if you have any specific problems, have him see me, or I'll, you know, see you as a family group. And I said, well, I thank you for that. But after that, I just felt that short inner period that he was there, I didn't sense
even remember him.
Well, I can't remember his name. That shows you... Well, it shows you that I'm losing my neurons. That's what it shows.
Maybe he was just not a memorable
person. No, he wasn't a memorable person. But, you know, apparently, from what everybody told me, before he became chairman of psychiatry and acting dean, he did come with some credentials, you know. And he left as a dean somewhere else, okay? So, but I don't remember him leaving a footprint, you know, on the college. Even though I made a concerted effort after that party of yours to meet with him to go over some things and even the history of our department, because he seemed to be interested. And then finally, when Glenn Davis came, and I'm going to be able to end now. I don't know why it was the fanfare of his coming and my hearing him for the first time when he met with the faculty. I just sense that there is a breath of fresh air finally coming to this medical school that may save it. Not that I was naive enough to think that we could go back to the womb and recreate the elements that made us sense that we had something unique and good, and a sense of family, a sense of mission. I didn't think we could ever do that. I mean, I'm not that naive. But I did sense in him that here was an intellectual, here was a person who would stand up to central administration and try to kick ass and make this medical school a school of I don't want to say quality, because that would imply it's not of quality even today. Obviously, the proof is in the pudding. Our students do well. But I had a feeling that he had a feeling that, what's the word I want to use, acceptance of what's okay. There's a special word for that. It's not mediocre. Complacency.
Mm-hmm.
That he wasn't about to acknowledging what we have today as being good enough. That he wanted to go beyond that. So we had a great history of making a community-based medical school. Our students are going out doing well, but we can do better. He conveyed that to me. He's very articulate. He came to the department and he discussed these things. I really sensed for the first year he was here, first year and a half he was here, he had a steep hill to climb. He had to swim with sharks, stupid sharks, but one that I thought he had thick skin and ability to do well. Well,
What happened?
What happened is what now closes my recollections of our medical school, and that is one day we all picked up the Lansing State Journal to find out that Betsy DeVos and McPherson, over brandy and cigars, I don't know if Betsy smoked, but 4 years ago, had decided to move the medical school to Grand Rapids. What a cockamamie idea. I sensed that the morning I saw that article. I stopped, as I normally do, at the International Bread Company to get a scone and then pick up a cup of coffee at Beaner's. And talking to laypersons in both of those places about this news, everything from what is going on here. The students didn't know anything about it. The faculty didn't know anything about it. Nobody was informed. Yet this decision was made by Betsy DeVos and McPherson. What we didn't know at that time even was this decision was made 4 years before. And how did we find this out? Well, through a few slips, one of which occurred when our chairman, our current chairman, Deli Davis, in answer to our faculty's question about when did he hear about it, you know, we thought maybe a couple weeks before he had been informed by the dean or all the chairmen were, and he said, yeah, we were told by the dean a couple weeks ago that this was all coming. So we accepted that. The dean came, and then we had this meeting scheduled at the that business school at the University Club. And McPherson and Luanna Simon and the less so the dean were there to meet with all the faculty about what was going on. It was supposed to be where they were going to inform us on all this stuff. I don't know if you were there.
I was not.
You were not there. Well, there were quite a few faculty. They filled the auditorium there in the business school. What do they call it? The Henry Center. The Henry Center. And some very tough questions were asked by the Howard Brodies, by Nigel Paneth, by individual faculty members to McPherson. And McPherson kept using the phrase, we're going to move to Grand Rapids. And Luanna would pipe in to correct the word move, but rather we're going to, what was the word she wanted us to use? Not move, but
expand.
To expand. And he kept using the word move. She would stand up and say, Peter, we're expanding, not moving. Well, that didn't set well with anybody. The meeting was not very satisfying to anybody who came out of it. So it was a couple, maybe weeks or months later. I don't even remember the context, but it had to be in a public meeting because Deli didn't say this to me personally. I'm just trying to, this is very critical. It may have been, oh, I know what it was. It was a small meeting in the conference room in the Life Science Building where the senior faculty wanted to meet with the executive committee while Deli was gone to talk about the rumor that the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development was going to be one of the first departments to move to Grand Rapids. And the clinicians especially wanted to ask, how are we going to approach Deli? Is he going to move to Grand Rapids or not? And it was somebody at that meeting who apparently knew the details of his negotiation to come here. And he said, and it might have been Iron Gungwab, said that during the negotiation to bring Deli here, he was told 4 years ago that part of his agreement to move here was when the medical school moves to Grand Rapids, he would go. And he agreed to accept the position here on those on that basis. That was told to us at this small meeting. So that really upset me about two people, at least two people. First, Dean Davis, because he led everybody to believe this was only told to him late in the sequence. He himself must have been told that when he was recruited to come here. And Deli never let any one of the faculty know this because that was a part of his negotiation to come here 4 years ago. They kept this secret. Then as the open meeting to the whole university, you know, discuss this plan, which was first a revelation for me that that was the first academic senate meeting that had a quorum in, what was it, 12 years, whatever it was.
Since the vote on going from a semester.
It was a huge number of years. And the mealy-mouthed comments that were made by the administration, not the least of which was McPherson and Luana Simon, didn't satisfy anybody. And I just came away totally discouraged. So, finally, to end on a note of very mixed feelings, because in all honesty, I can say when I look back at my years in a clinical department as a human geneticist specializing in human cancer and other chronic diseases of children, I was able to develop a career that I know has to be viewed, at least by me, as productive, as significant as possibly I could have ever had anywhere. In other words, I achieved many things I never thought I could when I started. In spite of the system, in spite of the lack of resources, the lack of a lot of things that possibly, and I'll say this on a public record here, that had I been at a Stanford or a Johns Hopkins and done as much as I have done, I probably would have been recognized formally. Not that I'm, you know, in lust of a Nobel Prize or a National Academy, so, but I would have clearly been recognized in a formal manner much more so than I have been. I'm internationally known now, okay, but with that same scientific contributions that I've made here, if I had done so at a Johns Hopkins, at a Harvard, Stanford, even University of Michigan, I would have been nominated into, you know, special categories.
How about if you'd been in one of the basic science disciplinary departments instead of pediatrics here?
That's a fair and important question to what I alluded to earlier. I would not have succeeded because part of the scientific success I had was the freedom I had to cross disciplines. Mm-hmm. And it's because I made those treacherous ventures that I stumbled into things I could not have done in a traditional department. Now, mind you, I might have stayed in that one trench and found a nugget that would I'll never know. No one will ever know. I'm an N of one. Okay, I don't have a control for myself. But all I know is the success I have had because of Bill Wild giving me the freedom, and even Marshall giving me the freedom, and definitely Helfer giving me the freedom. And really the freedom, and by the way, I haven't even mentioned Al Sparrow, but even the freedom Netzloff and Sparrow and to the last Chairman Dellie Davis has given me, that freedom was, I don't know what the hell you're doing, just keep doing it, you know. It wasn't one of encouragement, but one of benign neglect, which I took advantage of.
Pretty important.
So that's why I say that I have at this moment mixed feelings. The positive mixed feelings was the fact that I was able to develop a career that I owe in large part the positive opportunities the department gave me that didn't cut me off at the knees because I ventured outside the department. To them, this last commentary I give great credit for. By the same token, had I been a different person, a person who in a candy store cannot control how to deal with so many options, I may have failed as many in our department have.
But that's why some people left.
That's right. That's exactly. And I remember telling that to recruits. If you don't have, first, you're going to walk into a medical school, clinical or scholarly wise, that will give you so many options. But if you don't have self-control, if you don't have the proper guidance, you're going to drown in all of these options and not being able to develop in any one area. I told them all, it's a kid in a candy store syndrome. And I was able to survive that. And in large part, I think it has a lot to do with my own personality. We have to take credit and responsibilities for some of the good, bad things. But that's one thing. I saw options. I took advantage of the options. I stuck through them even under hard times, negative circumstances, no pat on the back, no encouragement, no incentives, except that I sensed myself that I was going in the right direction and no one's getting in my way. And I thank the Bill Wilds for that.
Sometimes benign neglect.
It's exactly it. Other people can't handle that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now the negative thing that I have in regrets, and again, that wonderful sense of mission and family that we had, we lost that innocence. And right now, our department has nothing. It has no sense of mission. None of the clinicians, none of the scholars, non-clinicians in the department, they're all atomistic. They're all trying to save their own ass, if you will. They have to survive. There's no sense of coherence, no support system for them. And now, with me leaving soon, Al Sparrow's leaving in this year.
Yeah,
he told me he's leaving this year. That's it. The connection with the past is gone. The living history of the department is gone. Those young people who are there, the clinicians, we don't know each other, we don't interact with each other, there's no sense of family, there's no sense of mission, and we have, unfortunately, a young chairperson, Dudley Davis, who has a lot of ability, and he's motivated to do something good, but he's so inexperienced, and he's really well over his head. Mm. Because he's in a situation where nationally, statewide, university-wide, and within the context of our college, he has no support. And I suspect he's going to drown. The department's going to drown. What does this do to the patients, but more importantly, the future of the medical students in pediatrics? That's my fear. And I said this even when you were here, because I remember reading that article in Academic Medicine, the title of which is Academic Medicine an Oxymoron? Who are we hiring to educate the future physicians? They're not academic. None of them.
Well, the future physicians need educating, or do they need teaching? When they have the little handheld computers with evidence-based medicine, they need to know how to ask the questions, but the answers will
pop up on the screen.
Be all computerized.
Ah, boy, you really hit the nail on the head, because the practical reality is going in that direction. Whether the so-called education will virtually replace me and you with a computer screen.
Okay.
With the clinical skills being transmitted via a robotic mannequin. By the way, I saw that at the University of Nagasaki. It was just amazing. This plastic mannequin could be programmed so when it comes in on a gurney, it's wheezing, okay, or convulsing, or whatever. And the students are asked to put a probe or a monitor on it, and on the screen come clinical signs that mimic what the wheeze or whatever the mannequin is doing. And there they are, given all the multiple choices. You know, so what is going to happen, and unfortunately I think the implication of your point is well taken, is the development of skills to maneuver computer-based knowledge will be all important at the expense of letting the human brain do the analysis, the problem solving, if you will. Now, of an educator might say, well, maybe that's good, because the human brain is so faulty between two individuals or the same individuals under two different circumstances. Having factual representation of all clinical symptoms with, at this time, the underlying mechanisms for those symptoms, all the options are there. And with the new technology to provide test information to match one of those hypotheses for the mechanism to match with the symptom is a much more efficient way than to have all that information stuck in your head and for you to sort it out. They may have a point there. But in the end, I always go back to a situation I had with my son when he found my slide rule one day at my desk. He didn't know what the hell it was.
Nope.
And I had a discussion with him, and I said, let's solve this mathematical problem. He was in high school at the time taking a math class, trig class. And I says, here you have your Hewlett-Packard computer, handheld computer, and I have my slide rule. I want to find out who could give you the answer to this sine curve faster. And we did. My wife put a time clock there. We did it. Boom. I had the answer faster than he could punch in the appropriate program and numbers in the program on his Hewlett-Packard. Well, I get back to the point we're just trying to make here, and that is, even trying to take the square root of a number the old-fashioned way versus just putting it on your Hewlett-Packard computer and getting this slide. As long as you got a battery in that Hewlett-Packard, you can get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you needed that answer and you got no battery?
From the next chair has one. I don't know, you know. We're dinosaurs.
Yeah, we are dinosaurs. I'm you know, under another time, in fact, even the first time that you quizzed me on this, I probably made reference to either people or incidents, some anecdote about my recollection of my 30-plus years, almost going on 40 years in our department, that are different than what I've said here today. And that's not surprising. I mean,
there's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, there's some overlap, yep. Of course. But the human brain isn't like a CD disc, you know, unless the CD disc is corrupted. The human brain is corrupted more often. In the end, am I glad I made that decision? Am I glad that I had that serendipitous meeting of Andy Hunt on the beach in Muskegon? Am I glad I chose to decide after 2 hours with Bill Wilde to stay here instead of going to the McAllister College? Am I glad that I weathered all of those chairpersons, some of whom were giants? I consider Bill as being one of those. By the way, I never made reference to Al Sparrow other than just repeating what I said, that I didn't make reference to him before. Other than I've always felt Al has been a nice person. Again, he fell into the category of not getting in my way as chairperson. But I never felt that he exuded leadership quality to either try to restore what our department was, because he had at least one foot in that early history. But I don't think he ever had the fire in his belly to go the next step. He obviously is good at what he does in the clinic. He has the kind of personality that isn't abrasive. And to my knowledge, at least in my circumstances, I never had any problem with him. He's always been supportive in that sense to me and to Dr. Chang and my group. But I never sensed that the department was happy with him, especially the clinicians. They felt, just talk to people like Kaufman or Netzloff and others, that they never felt he served them well. Yep. That was my take on things anyway. So in the end, to the answer to the question, do I have any regrets? None whatsoever. I was able, you know, life is never one big silver plate with chocolate-covered strawberries, a bowl of cherries anyway. I'm going to be 67 years old. I have accomplished quite a bit in my life, particularly because I've devoted my whole life to this department in college. I sacrificed, and I should note this on the record here, aside from this year, taking my first vacation, I had never taken a vacation. I mean, I took a day off now and then, but never took an honest-to-God vacation. When Kay got her breast cancers this last March, a year ago, and finally started to recover from the massive amount of surgery and radiation and chemotherapy, I took her on a world vacation, you know, to Scandinavia, as you know. And for the first time, I guess...
And the world didn't stop.
No, that was a humbling experience to realize that it didn't stop. And I actually enjoyed sitting with her eating licorice ice cream in Stockholm, you know, on a nice sunny day near the ocean there, or the sea, I should call it. So that's it. Unless you can, you know, probe a question or two out of me on some aspect of something that I forgot or just went over.
I don't think, you know, I may want to bring you back again. Okay. When I go through one cycle.
Okay. Yeah, if I should live so long. Oh, you should live so long. All right, thank you.